The challenge is, I wrote to my boss in Sydney this morning, just a text, and I said, I feel as if I'm trying to shove a jumbo jet into the boot of a Camry. And that was when I thought I had 20 minutes, and I was told it was 15 minutes, so it's in the back of a Mini, really. So I won't have any sort of fun introduction. We'll just get straight into the question. If Jesus wasn't God, we'd lose nothing or more. And I want to suggest two key things that we'll lose if Jesus is actually not God. And the first is, we would lose any logical explanation for authentic Christianity. It really is impossible to make sense of the person of Jesus and the impact of Jesus if we come up with any other explanation other than that he was God. At first glance, you see, the idea that a man who lived for 33 years, you know, under Roman occupation in Israel could actually be the creator of heaven and earth, which is what the Bible means when it talks about God. This is not some sort of series of godettes you can have. The owner of all things, the Lord of all things, the judge of men and women, it's evidently foolish. It's just a silly idea. And unlike what the internet says and various people have lectured me on at various parties and taxis, it's just not true that the God becoming human is a common idea. There are all sorts of ideas of God's visiting and floating around, but the idea of God becoming flesh, that is actually a very, very rare idea. We can talk about that in the discussion part if you'd like. So at first glance it looks silly, but when you start to look at the actual historical information that we have about Jesus, both inside the New Testament, written by Christians, and outside the New Testament, it becomes very difficult to make any sense of him or the earliest bits of Christianity unless he was in fact God. And I want to suggest to you, the longer I've looked at it, and I keep trying to look at it afresh, I'm not interested in believing something because I used to believe it, or believing something because it you know, earns me this massive income I get, which I couldn't earn any more doing anything else. You know, if it's not true, I want out, frankly. And the longer I look at the evidence, the more I just find it difficult to understand why more people can't see it. I think the problem is people don't look at the evidence. Very hard for all of us, and I say this for myself as well, to get past my prejudices. To leave my prejudices on the side and look at the evidence again. But when you do that, even as briefly as we can now, you see it. It's extraordinary that the direction that all the evidence pushes. Let me give you an example. We've got writings, in spite of the lies of Dan Brown, who wrote The Da Vinci Code, and he's not, there's lots of books like it that lots of people read, and they have no idea of the history, so they find it convincing, because most people assume that if someone writes a book, they're not going to tell you an out-and-out lie, are they? Well, Dan Brown knows enough of the subject of the early parts of Christianity to know he's a bald-faced liar, and frankly, I hope he enjoys his money, because he's going to be in serious trouble sometime down the road, as I understand it, if Jesus is right. Because he makes out that Christians always just believe Jesus was a prophet and fine spiritual teacher up until about 300 AD. That's utter rubbish. We have a letter, of which there's no doubt at all, from a governor in sort of Turkey called Pliny, who writes to his uncle, who happens to be the emperor of Rome, seeking advice on what to do with Christians. 107 AD, so it's within, between Jesus and this letter is my mother's lifespan. In fact, my mum's lived much longer than that, so it's not a long time. And the thing he talks about the Christians is, amongst them, he says they're good citizens, but they won't worship the emperor. And he says they meet on the first day of the week, where they sing hymns to Jesus as unto God. Hadrian, an emperor, writes a letter about where he's talking about the fact that in Egypt people are becoming Christians. And he speaks there about the fact that they worship Jesus as a god. And we've got a terrific little bit of graffiti, which is probably from about, we're not quite sure exactly when, because graffitiists don't always date things in the ways that we could get it. But there's a bit of graffiti by a young man who's been trained to be a courtier, mocking one of his friend's religion. And it's from about 100 AD. We can't, not quite sure. But it's around about then. Again, it's within the sort of a lifetime of Jesus. And he's got a picture of, it's quite, you can find this on the net, he's got a picture of a cross with a guy on the cross with a donkey's head. And if Neil Downing in front of him is a man like this in a position of worship. And he's got written underneath it, Alexamenos worships his God. And archaeologists, they know what this is. This is mocking some Christian. This is a kid mocking his mate for his religion, because he worships a guy who dies on a cross. Right? And that's why he's given a donkey's head, because only fools die on crosses. So I'm saying, within a generation of Jesus' life, we've got three or four, and there are others, accounts from people who are not Christians, in fact they're enemies of Christians or just observers, saying they all worship Jesus as God. Now why would they do that? These, you've got to remember, it's hard for us sometimes to do decent history and realize these are Jews. The heart of Christianity, and Hitler was right, and Nietzsche was right, that Christianity is a form of Judaism. That's where it comes from. And the one thing the Jews have died by the hundreds and thousands of, I sometimes tell this to my Islamic friends who tend, on the many of them, not to like the Jews. I say, the Jews were the only monotheists in the time of Jesus. They died by the hundreds to defend the truth that between God and the creation, there is a massive gap. You must not confuse what's on what side of that gap. Why would the early Christians, who were Jews, come to the notion that God had become a man? If you're a Greek and you had a very small view of God and a very big view of man, you can sort of play with that idea a little bit. Where'd they get this stupid idea from that they were then willing to die for? See, we know from Jewish writings that what the gospel writers say that the early Jews said about Jesus is exactly what they say. You can read this in the Talmud. There are a number of collections, the Babylonian and the Palestinian Talmud. They're collections of the writings of the rabbis from before and after the time of Jesus. And there are a number of references to Jesus. Yeshu is what they call him. They speak about the fact they put him to death, and they're quite unashamed of it. They put him to death on the eve of Passover. They gave him a fair trial. They named five of his disciples. And they say that they put him to death for blasphemy. That is the most serious offence you can do to God, is to blur that line, to put yourself on the wrong side of it. And one particular guy, Rabbi Eleazar ben Hyrcanus III, now there's a great name, makes it even palatable. It's such a dull name, I must say. Eleazar Hyrcanus III, brought to you by Virgin Airlines. But he's got five things about Jesus. He's a liar, he's a sorcerer, the miracles, and he was put to death because he, being a man, made himself out to be God, which is exactly what we find the Jews recorded the saying in John's Gospel. That the enemies of Jesus will tell you that this guy claimed to be God. Now, how can you... It's difficult to make sense of the historical data. Then you come to what the friends of Jesus say. As a scholarly friend of mine says, the trouble with the Bible is the myths are not so much in the New Testament, they're about the New Testament. A terrific job has been done on the New Testament in the last 50 years. Even when I was growing up in the 70s, we all knew the Bible was rubbish. You just know that. You don't have to study it. You just know it. But the Gospels themselves, particularly in the last 40, 50 years, in leading edge scholarship, have got a whole new life of respect, etc., which they deserve. But what drove the first Christians, if I can just do it in a few seconds, to the idea that Jesus really was God? An idea they would not have got to easily as Jews. That was a repulsive idea. I think I've learned quite a lot from my Islamic friends. They find the idea disgusting, that God should become a human and be born from between the legs of a woman. And all the bodily fluids and stuff like that. They say it's a blasphemous idea. It's the law of the duck with Jesus. You know the law of the duck? If it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck and swims like a duck and duck dives like a duck and flies like a duck, what is it? It's a flipping duck. And people sometimes say, and I've had one of my friends, Mustafa Arja, said, if you can just find me a statement, Jesus, I'm God, we'll consider it. I say, fine. If in any of that logic, you find me a statement where Jesus says, I'm a prophet, which they're absolutely convinced. He doesn't teach like that. He's actually a much better teacher than that. What he does is he's the classic perfect teacher where he puts the information in front of you and then maybe asks you the right question. So you go, my goodness. That's who you are. So what he does is he just speaks in a way that no man should speak. And we can miss this, but this is why it's really helpful to look at what his contemporaries say. He says to a man who's crippled, he says, young man, your sins are forgiven. Now anyone who knows anything about God, Christian, Jew, Muslim, whatever, anyone who believes in the God who creates and who judges, will say what the religious leaders said in Mark 2 and other places. They said, who does this man think he is? This is blasphemy. Who can forgive sins except God alone? Absolutely. They've got it. They've worked it out. So when Jesus says, your sins are forgiven, not, I will pray that God will forgive your sins. He just speaks as if he has the authority to forgive. You will not find that. Moses never ever does that. Muhammad never ever does that. Only God can say your sins. So what Jesus does is, he does, and his contemporary's response tells you the meaning of it if you're in any doubt. Or another one, which is one of these miracle stories that if the Christians had half a brain, they would never have told anyone, because it's self-evidently foolish. And it's not with parallel in the ancient world, even the modern world. Jesus in a boat, you probably know the story, in a boat with professional sailors. The storm is so savage, and we know the Sea of Galilee has these storms that blow up in a minute, that Jesus simply stands up when they're all panicking and says to the wind, well, he's quite rude. He uses the equivalent in his language of shut up. He says to the wind, shut up, because it would have been howling and screaming, and says to the waves, sit down. And they do. And the eyewitness accounts tell us that those who saw it were terrified. Jesus turns, what are you frightened of? And then the eyewitness said, they were terrified. What of? Not of the calm. And they said, who is this man that even the wind and the waves obey him? Our pilot on the Virgin Airlines flight this morning was apologizing to me 45 minutes late, but he said, we're just not able to control the weather yet.
Yeah.
Right? Which was right. But this is the absurdity that the early Christians said Jesus did. Why? Because they saw it. Right? And Jesus would just put himself where only God should be, and that's why his contemporaries killed him. In the end, if you say Jesus isn't God, there's no logically sensible explanation for what the observers, the enemies, and his friends say. It just makes sense of the data. It's uncomfortable, but it's the way things are. Now, secondly, and here we're really, I wouldn't do this with a Sydney audience, they're too slow, but now I want to try with some work with some really pretty deep philosophy. You don't necessarily have to believe it, but at least hear it. Not only would you lose any possible sensible explanation of the real data about Jesus, historical data, but you'd lose the power and genius of Christianity at its best if Jesus is not God. The passage that was read for you, you'll probably recognise how John has been very cheeky when he starts the life of Jesus. It's a kind of the overture for the gospel that he begins. He echoes one of the most magnificent bits of prose in any language. And this is, I'm not saying this as a Christian, many, many would say that. It's the beginning of Genesis, the very beginning of the Bible, where it says, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. And on it goes. When Apollo 8 was the first time ever to see the Earth rise over the Moon as it came round the back, the astronauts were actually taken to court over this by the American League of Civil Liberties or whatever it was, and they lost, thankfully. William Anders, the man in charge of the three men, said, we're now approaching the lunar Earth rise. And for all the people back on Earth, the crew of Apollo 8 have a message we'd like to send to you. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And he read the first about eight verses, then he handed over to Lovell, who read the next lot, and the last guy read them. And they just read this magnificent, even if you don't believe it, it's magnificently written. And John, very cheekily, when he begins his gospel, it's like me starting a symphony. Here's my first symphony, it goes like this, boom, 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 boom. And you think, hang on, that belongs to someone else, right? So he goes, in the beginning. And anyone who, all the fellow Jews that he's writing, are like, yeah, we know this. This is, this in the beginning, God created the heaven. No. In the beginning was the Word. And the Word was with God. And the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through him all things were made. And it's an extraordinary beginning. Because what he says is something which the Jews had died by the hundreds for. He sort of doesn't deny it, but he twists it. He says, in the beginning was the Word. The Word was with God. So instead of this being this picture of this monad, this lonely, I don't know what other word to use, this alone God, he's saying there was somebody with God, somebody called the Word, the self-expression, the logic. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. And the next statement is, it's hard for us living on this side of this to get what an unthinkable next statement this is for a Jew. And the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And what he's doing is, and in case you missed it, he says again, he was with God in the beginning. And the word with means he was sort of leaning towards. I don't know if you've ever had, you know, the beginning of a relationship with a girl or something like that. There's that lovely moment when you suddenly realize that they're leaning into you, you know, and that sort of, and it's a nice feeling. And that's what he's saying, that's what the word is like to God. There's just this intimacy as they lean in towards each other. And what it's saying is, what we lose, I'm going to turn that off, what we, I'm cheating. What we gain from this is this, is it what the New Testament keeps on saying, there's only one God. What it says is, but it's a complex unity. He is they. That he wasn't alone, God. There was this companion, to use the word that my friends get so offended by, within God. And it wasn't just beside God, he was God, made of the same stuff. And in case there's any doubt, the next couple of verses will say how he made all things, which is the defining mark of God in the Bible. And what it's saying is this, and this is where it gets a bit philosophical, but I think it's quite wonderful. And the Bible and the early Christians never play with this, they just work this out hundreds of years after. It means this, that the very heart of absolute reality, right, is a community of love. It's persons in relationship. Now, why is that significant? If you're a consistent atheist, and at one level, thankfully, very few atheists are. I mean, Christians aren't likely to have been consistent either, but we're all committed to it. The French atheists are the best at this. They recognize that at the heart of everything is pure energy. It's the best we can do. Right? Energy, or something like that. When you go, whatever, you can't even talk about what's before the Big Bang. But in the end, it's just energy. And some leading atheists have described human personality with all its longings and hopes and dreams and fears as scum on the pond of the universe. That's all it is. Richard Dawkins used to be much more courageous on this than he has. He's realised that sort of philosophy is never going to sell and fly. So when he was here for the last time, and he'll be back again for the little Hillsong Atheist conference they'll have, where they'll all sing and dance and worship. That's what one of my atheist mates thinks. It's going to be a yes conference. Everyone's going, yes, yes, yes. There's going to be no real serious disagreement on anything. But, you know, he used to speak about the harshness. Just get used to the fact the universe is a harsh place. There's no room for sentimentality. Ultimate reality is just energy. It doesn't love. Human personality is a freakish accident. It means nothing. It's going nowhere. The trouble with that is the human heart doesn't believe it. So Peter Singer, who's a very impressive man in so many ways, a Melbourne atheist and big boy overseas, he's famous for his argument that at either ends of life, people should be put out of their misery. They're a waste of money and resources. There's no inherent value in the person. But he's also a bit famous for the fact that he's pouring a fortune into looking after his mum, who's dying slowly. She's a very old woman. I think she's got something like Alzheimer's disease. You see, the beauty is he's not consistent. She should just be snuffed out. She's a waste of money. At that point, his heart is right where his head is wrong. What the Bible's saying is this. If you lose the fact that Jesus is God and that at the heart and the root of ultimate reality is actually a community of love, the Father, the Son, and later on in John's Gospel we'll learn about the Spirit, always been there. This is what makes beautiful sense of what the human heart hopes is true, that what matters is people and love. And that's more significant than just brute force and energy. One of the reasons why, if you read the 99 names of God in Islam, what they don't have is, and particularly if Islam is a step on from Christianity, you would expect it to have the one great affirmation the New Testament has, which is God is love. It can't say that, Islam. Because if God is a monad, solitary, he would be lonely. And a lonely God is a contradiction in terms. And of course, if God is a community, if in the beginning was the Word, the self-expression of God, you can't get behind the time when there was God and the Word who becomes flesh. Then it actually makes sense of human longing. Doesn't mean it's true, but we want to be consistent. An atheist who's consistent may be nice, but they would be irrational. Like Sartre says, come and love me irrationally, because he realised human personality is an accident and meaningless. So the two things I want to suggest to you is this. If we lose or haven't seen yet that Jesus is actually God, there's no other way to make sense of the data about Jesus. You can dance around the individual pieces of it. But it's like an avalanche. It's not the individual snowflake that kills you. It's the 7 zillion of them going in the same direction. And you'll also lose in the end any logical, rational basis for what the human heart hopes is true, And Christianity kind of accidentally discovered that because at the heart of everything is a community of love. I'll shut up so there's some time for questions.
So,
any thoughts, reflections, questions? Yeah. Yes, sir.
Three points. First, if Jesus wasn't executed, what then?
Yeah.
Second, it has been said that Jesus was a reforming Jew who mistakenly believed that the end of the world would come either in his lifetime or the lifetime of his immediate prophets. His essential message was, repent, the kingdom of heaven is at hand. Third, the majority of Jews of Jesus' time did not see any reason to believe the amazing story and see absolutely no reason to believe it now.
Now let me try and deal with three huge points, see if I can even remember them. Let me go backwards. It is true, in fact, the verses actually here will say, and I think, which I didn't get to deal with, sorry. Just the verses just before this, I've left out from John 10, speaks about the fact that he came to his own, but he was rejected. As the Old Testament and Isaiah 53 and other places suggest that when God sends his servant, the prediction was 600 years before he came that he would be fundamentally rejected and suffer. So yes, it is true that as predicted, Jesus was rejected by his very own people. At the same time, Jews are continually becoming Christians. My boss is a converted Jew. One of my colleagues is a converted Jew. One of my best friends from Shaw School is a converted Jew. Jews are constantly coming to Christ. So yes, I mean, the same thing happens in the end, that people have to look at Jesus. And one of the reasons, in fact, the primary reason Jesus gives why people reject him is not for want of evidence, but because we don't want him. So, I mean, my own experience was very clear to me because it was mine. I did not want to become a Christian. I did not need to become a Christian. I did not want a God. I had a perfectly functioning God. That was me. And the great thing with this God was I could get him to believe anything. So I could change my moral stance whenever it was convenient. That the human heart is both, and I may have used this phrase last week, is both addicted to God and allergic to God. We don't mind religion. Everyone's got religion. But we know the history of the Old Testament. I remember saying to an atheist debater once, I was asking a question and didn't get a follow-up, unfortunately. I said, the most anti-Semitic book in the world is probably the Old Testament. He said, no, that's the New Testament, which is one of the silly arguments people have. That is, the Old Testament is constantly hammering the Jews. They're Jews hammering the Jews for not living like Jews. Right? And the history of the Jews is exactly as the history of the Christian church and others, which is we often persecute and drive out those who stand closest to God and call us back. Jesus is a reforming Jew. Those sorts of views are normally taken by people who've already, at least historically, the ones that I've read, because this was a great movement in the 19th century, gets rerun on the ABC and other things like that. They're normally from people who've already made the decision, he is not God, therefore what category can we put him in? The problem with those things is they normally can take one or two lines of the scriptures and make sense of it. One of the problems with it is that this say, for example, the writing in the Talmud, where the Jews say of Jesus exactly what the Gospels say they say, which is powerful when you've got the friends of Jesus writing saying, this is what the people who killed him said. Now we've got the writings of the enemies of Jesus, and it's exactly what they said. It's one of the confirmations for the general straightforwardness of the Gospel writers, that they didn't put horrible words into the mouths of their enemies. They put exactly, almost word for word, what these guys said. So there are other ways of understanding Jesus, and there's money to be made, and books will keep coming out, trying to put Jesus into a form that is not as scary and not as unique. Because it's the uniqueness of Jesus that people, the early Roman philosophers, found so offensive. They mock Christianity for its claim to uniqueness. See, the world was multicultural, much more so in the time when Christianity started than it is now. Multiculturalism was new for us to deal with, but the Roman world was classically multicultural. I think I'll stop there and throw, if there are any other questions.
If Jesus were not executed,
well, I had a point here, but I left out, which is that the two poles around which the energy in Christian thinking move are the Word became flesh, which I didn't get to, the one who was with God and through whom God made all things actually became flesh, that great truth, and what it says about how God is now accessible to man, because we don't have to imagine our way up, but God actually comes down to us. You may know that in Islam, in classical Islam, you can't know God. You can only know the will of God. So what Muslims do is they submit. That's what Muslim means, one who submits. They submit to the will of God. It's because they're right. Philosophically, you can't work your way up to the eternal. But at the heart of Christianity, it's saying that the Word became flesh. And it uses the most grotesque word you can use for human flesh. It could have used the word human, which is noble. It uses the word flesh, gristle, fat. You know, that's what, he became one of us and lived among us so we could see him. And so we could. So Jesus says, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. It's one of the many things. No one would say that. Moses would never say that. Muhammad would kill you if you said that in his presence. You want to see what Allah's like, look at me. Right? Jesus says it. So this is one of the things that it's the making sense of it. The other great pole is the death of Jesus. That we have a God who has created the world with freedoms which have been misused and caused terrible suffering for all of us, and God actually comes into this world and suffers with us and dies. So it's the idea that God has entered into this world. It's a good world that God can happily enter, but it's a broken world and he comes to die. So if it is, the Bible predicts he will come and die, so I'm not sure how I can even do a thought experiment on what would happen if he hadn't.
The whole story would just collapse.
Yeah. Yeah, because it's not like John Lennon who gets shot accidentally by a lone madman. Jesus speaks about his execution.
I thought he whizzed off to India or France.
Oh, there's a thousand possibilities. Yes, yes. I mean, and absolutely. And people often, yes. There's a lot of, you can write theories, there's money to be made in books about Jesus that help us to avoid him. Any other different, did you get the philosophic stuff? Was that, as I say, I wouldn't try that with Sydney, but we're far too dull, but you know.
The question I had about that was, has someone asked that question of Peter Singer? Has he recognised that perhaps there's an inconsistency in his own personal view,
yes,
as to what his actual writings are? I would be really interested to hear if there's a response,
yes,
around that question.
I've not heard it, but I'm sure someone would have. I mean, Peter Singer, you know, he works at Princeton, the place is loaded, well, I think it's Princeton, it's loaded with Christian scholars. I'm sure he would have had those discussions. What atheists, I don't know what Peter Singer would say, but what atheists say is in the end what Jean-Paul Sartre says, come and love me irrationally. Mm-hmm. A consistent atheist will see that there is no inherent value in a human. We are just accidental products of a purposeless, mindless universe. We've come from nowhere, we're going to nowhere. My children seem to me to be worth the earth. But that's an illusion. If atheism is true, and I think we all should try to live our beliefs consistently. If atheism is true, they're nothing other than chemicals. Mildly complicatedly arranged for a split second before they go back to nothing. If they die, the universe couldn't give a damn. I could care, but I'm not worth anything. So we all matter to people who don't matter. Which is why atheism, you've got guys like Albert Camus writes the book about being sick. I've forgotten the name of it, but he is like Sartre. He's a consistent atheist. What is it? It's not the plague. It's a word for sickness. It's a short book about this guy who just realizes the utter pointlessness of life if there's no God, and it makes him sick. I forgot the name of the book, but you'll find if you ever see it. Might be Nausea. I think it's Nausea. It's the English translation, and it's to do with the French atheists, unlike the English and American atheists, tended to take atheism to its logical end, and they said, therefore, although we feel these things matter, we know they don't. And I think what Christianity is saying is, think better about the evidence about Jesus, and you'll find actually that your brain and your heart can pump together. When Bob Dylan became a Christian, I have no idea where he's at now, who can ever follow that man, he wrote a song called A Satisfied Mind, which is how he described becoming a Christian. But I think what you get is a satisfied mind and a satisfied heart. I've discovered the heart stuff. This thing about the Trinity, that the heart of the universe is a loving community. That's beautiful in terms of the truth it reveals, if it's true. You want to ask one last question? Yeah.
Sorry, just two quick comments. One, just I suppose a comment about that Peter statement that was made about Jesus being a reforming Jew. I think obviously as Lewis answered that one very well when he said Jesus is either a learned grew to be
yes.
just a prophet simply by the claims that he made about himself.
Yes.
He left that option open.
Yes.
So that's one thing I'd say about that. The other point I can't remember what it
okay.
was.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I think the awkward thing with Jesus is the words that he says. Now, there was a tendency 200 or 300 years ago to say he didn't say them. That's actually the reason why they dated the Gospels late. It's interesting. Why did we get to the view which we had in the 18th century, in the 19th, still gets said sometimes, that the Gospels were a long time after Jesus? There was no historical evidence. That came out of a dogma that said, we know there isn't really a God, or at least there's no God who gets involved in the earth. How could it be that the Christians could get him so confused that this little lovely teaching guy was now being worshipped as a God? Well, you need hundreds of years for that mythology to develop, although, interestingly enough, it never developed with Moses, and it never developed with Muhammad, and never developed with Isaiah. It's just not a thing that people need to do. But so they had to push the dates hundreds of years later. That was purely from dogma, not from history. And thankfully, in the last 30 years, that's come closer. But he does make shocking things, and I'll shock you and sit down and shut up.